Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. Galen Ross. We're going to be talking about his book, Elite Serial Killers. Of Lincoln, JFK, RFK, and MLK, Martin Luther King. Now, you have to understand that Mr. Ross has written another book which we carry. It's called Who's Who in the Elite, and of course, it is an expose of the members of the Council on Foreign Relations. What is the Council on Foreign Relations? Well, it's a front group for a secret society that was created in England in 1891. It metastasized to the United States in 1921, and by the middle or the beginning of the Second World War, it really controlled our State Department. It interlocks with the great tax-exempt foundations, with the great fortunes, with the people who control most of our major corporations, our universities. It interlocks with the Rhodes Scholarships. We find that the Secretary of State, with, I think, one exception since 1953, and that was James Baker III, was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I think that actually James Baker eventually joined. We find that all but one director of the CIA since 1953 has been a member of the CFR. It doesn't matter whether the Democrats or Republicans are in office. They control the executive branch of government. They have their people on the courts. They control the media. The most powerful people in the world. So Who's Who in the Elite is a very important book. And, of course, we can tell you how to get that through our ministry if you're interested. Who's Who in the Elite by Galen Ross. But this evening, we're going to be talking about his book, The Elite Serial Killers of Lincoln, JFK, RFK, and MLK. Galen, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to join you again.
Galen, are you there?
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Galen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, hello. I don't know why we can't... we'll be with you in just a minute.
Hello.
There we are. Okay, fine. Okay. I have three sets of earphones, and we got the wrong one on. I use the afternoon earphones instead of the evening earphones, and I started out with the early afternoon earphones. So anyway, it's good to have you with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Stan.
All right. Now, of course, Galen has done a great deal of really fundamental research going into the background of who it was who killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy and why, and of course has talked to many of the people who were involved or knew people who were involved in the killing of John Kennedy, and certainly the same would be RFK. But tonight he wanted to talk about Chapter 9 of his book, which gets into the FBI's effort to discredit Martin Luther King. Now, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about this? Would it be that the FBI would actually try to influence the attitude of the American people towards various political people or people involved in the political process?
Yes, it actually goes back to the 1970s, I believe 76 or 77, when the Senate at that time was not controlled by the elite, and so we have a couple of Senate hearings. One exposed the CIA's involvement in the MK Ultra mind control program, and the other was the one that exposed the involvement of the FBI in the destruction and actual killing of Martin Luther King, and his they discredited him everywhere they could,
Now, of course, that was headed by Frank Church. And, of course, yes. He was a Democrat, and all good Republicans don't like Frank Church because he was a Democrat. And yet, when I read a lot of the things he wrote, why he was really a patriot. He was concerned about what was happening in America. He was concerned by the fact that the CIA would assassinate anybody they wanted to and would back corrupt regimes. And he was concerned about our loss of constitutional rights. In fact, I have a report which we offer to people. We call it the Report on the executive orders, talking about really how the framework was laid out even back in 1972 to establish a dictatorship, suspend the Constitution, and how we really had not been operating really under the Constitution going back to the executive orders that were put through by Franklin Delano Roosevelt to create a state of emergency in 1932, and we've been under it constantly up until 1972 when the report came out. And we're still under it today. And, of course, that's how they can actually declare this police state that they're in the process of declaring with the new USA Patriot Act and the Office of Homeland Security and the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act and the TIPS program. That's where the Terrorism Information and Prevention System, by which they will hire or somehow or other get your mailman and your delivery man and the people who read your meters, and everybody will be spying on everybody else in the name, of course, of fighting terrorism. But it has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. It is simply the same technique that the Stasi used in East Germany, that the communists use in Mao's China, and that, of course, Cuba that has in place today. And they're imposing it right here in the name of fighting terrorism, which is, of course, why nothing was done to stop the September 11th attack. How else would you get the American people to go along with that and with the coming war in the Middle East? So let's get back, and I'll get off my soapbox and let you do the talking. You're talking about this report then that came out in the 70s under the Democratic control of the Senate, where they were trying to look into the background of what the FBI was really doing.
Yes, the FBI, it came out in April 14th, 1976 report by the Intelligence Activities and Rights of Americans by the Select Committee to Study of Government Operations headed by Frank Church. And they uncovered a number of things that the FBI were doing. One was what they called a COINTELPRO program. That's a counterintelligence program where they actually followed Martin Luther King. They bugged every room he was in. They tried to brand him as a communist. They put out rumors saying that he had both white and black women waiting in line to sleep with him. They would plant good-looking black ladies in the office where he worked, hoping that he would hit on them. And all these things that they tried to do to discredit Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Now, this was all covered in this Senate report.
It's all in the Frank Church report. Gives all the details of all the things that they did to discredit King and the other black leaders of those times.
Now, that, of course, nothing has really changed. They did the same thing to my friend Pat Matriciano. They had people planted in his office to disrupt his office and, of course, steal his information files and, destroy his computerized system. And eventually they got him tangled up in a lawsuit with some FBI agents. The FBI agents were there, of course, to undermine him. They had an agent named John Brown feed him phony information. Pat thought that John was his friend. And apparently, at least according to the information that we have in a book called Hunting the President, John Brown, Pat Matriciano's friend, was really an FBI informant, feeding him bad information to get him involved in a lawsuit. And then the FBI agents who were supposedly trying to track down the killers of the boys on the railway track in Mena, Arkansas, actually testified against Pat to get him, really bankrupt him with a lawsuit. And it was all an FBI sting operation, just like they went out to get DeLorean. So I guess nothing has really changed, has it? Whatever you give power to people in government, it'll always be misused.
That's correct. And in the case of the CIA, they're protected by the 1947 National Security Act. Anything evidence relating to anything CIA does cannot be brought into court, either civil court or criminal court against the CIA.
So we'll never be able, of course, to convict the people who were behind the September 11th attack then, because as one of them recently said in the book, it's quoted by Robert Baer, it's called See No Evil, he was 25 to 30 years working for the CIA, quoting a high official in the CIA saying, well, when the dust is settled, why, of course, what happened on September 11th will be looked upon not as a failure, but as a success. How could September 11th be a success unless, of course, the death of those 3,000 people who died that day was for another purpose, that the CIA had a purpose? And, of course, we know that instead of firing George Tenet for dereliction of duty and allowing that to happen, why, the president congratulated the head of the CIA for a job well done immediately after the September 11th attack. Maybe that explains why the high official had told a reporter off the record that September 11th was not a failure but a success. Incidentally, the book, See No Evil, Robert Baer. Go ahead.
And it really goes to a statement made by a fellow named Henry Kissinger at the Bilderberg meeting in Evian, France on May the 21st, 1992, which was transcribed by on a tape recorder made by a Swiss delegate. And at this Bilderberg meeting, Henry Kissinger says, "Today Americans would be outraged if UN troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow they would be grateful. This is especially true if they were told there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threaten our very existence. It is then that all people of the world will plead with the world leaders to deliver them from this evil. The one thing every man fears is the unknown. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will be willingly relinquished for the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by their world government." Well, that was in 1992. And the World Trade Center and the Pentagon crashes were not caused by the elite, but they used this as an excuse to start tightening up the laws and taking away our freedoms.
I think that they knew it was coming, and they did not
try
to stop it.
They did know it was coming.
Sure. They knew it was coming. In fact, I did an interview this morning with a reporter from the Washington Times who, 2 months before the attack, had written about how they were going to hijack our planes and crash into the World Trade Center. Now, he says he didn't write the article. I have the article. I pointed out that we have it. It's there. Oh, and, of course, he'll do anything he can to admit that it was the greatest scoop of all time. I mean, anybody would like to see that copy. We'll be glad to get it for you if you give us a call. The reporter was Bill Gertz from Washington Times, who wrote the article in July. And now he denies he wrote the article. No, he said, "I was mistaken." How could you be mistaken? Because it happened. But I suppose that doesn't confuse anybody. Well, anyway, go ahead with your, with the, Galen. Of course, the thing is that in 1976, why the investigating committee of the Senate came out and said this whole thing was a conscious, organized, orchestrated effort by the government to change the perception of the American people towards Martin Luther King.
Yes, both he and other black leaders of the time, and they had a plan to eliminate Reverend King in the assassination in Memphis and replace him with a person that was much more amenable to the elite. That fellow's name is
Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Lewis Jackson.
Right, and of course, Jesse Jackson's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, did they actually mention that in the report, or is
no,
that?
No. That's that was in a report done by Sherman Skolnick.
All right, fine. So let's just sort of stick specifically with what this Senate committee report. But the Senate committee report said that the FBI had an organized plan to discredit Martin Luther King.
Yes, that's correct, and there are about three large volumes relating to the Senate hearing, and in the book I quote the appropriate comments.
Do you actually have those three volumes?
Yes, I have the volumes in my library.
I think that's really so important. Well, I'm so glad you got that, and of course you quote that in your book, The Elite Serial Killers. So tell us some of the other things that were in here, because I think it's vitally important that people understand what's brought out in these Senate committees that is suppressed by the controlled media.
They tried to find errors in Dr. King's tax returns. They tried everything they could do. They searched his bank accounts, looked for foreign bank accounts, couldn't find any. And they did everything they could to discredit this fine fellow, and turned out that everything that you heard, and I heard these rumors back in those days, and I believed them because I thought they came from a credible source, and it turned out that they were all lies promulgated by the FBI.
Well, what did the FBI do? Did they leak information to the media and
stuff? Yes. They have shields within the media that they feed information to, and they present these as research that they've done to find the real truth, and then they publish it, and then it's really all lies.
And I think people have to understand that all these so-called government leaks, they're not really government leaks. They're disinformation that's being put out to control the reality of the American people. And when you hear this high government official who cannot give his name, but he said off the record that, well, you know very well that this is what they want you to believe. In other words, they're creating a reality with these so-called government leaks. And this is pretty standard operating procedure, and it's being done today. Certainly, so much of what you hear about what's going on, the factors leading up to the war in the Middle East. Now, Saddam Hussein is a wicked and evil guy, no question at all, but they never mention we financed him. We gave him the chemical and biological agents. Anybody who doesn't believe that should get the book Against All Enemies. We have the world's last remaining supply of the book, but it's an important book. And then, of course, you really need to understand that that we left him in power in 1991. Again, in 1995, according to Robert Baer, a CIA man in the Middle East, why in 1995 the Iraqi military wanted to take him out, overthrow him. And we wouldn't let them. Why? This terrible, wicked man. Why would we want to keep him in power? Unless, of course, he would be very useful for the war that would be fought in 2002 and 2003. So most of what we believe, of course, is created by the images we hear on the radio and see on television and read in the newspaper. And many times they're created by our intelligence agencies, aren't they, Galen?
That's correct.
Okay.
And, I guess one of the greatest rewards I've had from printing or doing research and publishing this book is I met with Bernice King over the weekend and had quite a long meeting with her, and her statement to me was that she had been troubled all of her life about what had been said about her father. She didn't know whether to believe it or not. She'd been told, or there have been lots of stories about his death and who caused it and why it was done, and all the bad things he was supposed to have done. And she said after she read my book that she now was at ease. She knew the truth. She knew who was behind it, and she knew what it was all about. And that was very rewarding to me.
Well, of course, the thing is that let's get into why did our government agencies want to kill Martin Luther King? Because after all, he was a great American hero. I Have a Dream. He had led the civil rights movement. Certainly, he had gotten through the legislation which the establishment really wanted, and that, of course, was to increase the power of the federal government. By passing all these new laws, and rather than try to overcome prejudice and work, and use an American solution to solve an American problem, why they use a Marxist solution to solve an American problem? But why did they want to kill him after he had done such good work for them?
Well, they, Reverend King was speaking out against the Vietnam War. In fact, he planned to fly to Vietnam and meet with the black soldiers that were over there and ask them to lay down their arms and to not fight this terrible war. And he was also trying to get civil rights for the blacks at the time. And Johnson felt that if the blacks of the South had were given their civil rights and given the right to vote their mind, that he would probably lose the next coming election. So that was the two motives behind the killing of Martin Luther King. And the other one was that J. Edgar Hoover hated King and all the black leaders, and That it troubled me that the head of the director of the FBI would be so strongly against any leader, particularly the black leaders, and then someone sent me an article that was that answered that question for me, and the title of the article was "Black Like Me," and it turned out that J. Edgar Hoover's great grandmother was a black lady from Tennessee. And he hated the fact that he had black blood, and he took it out on the black leaders at the time.
Well, he, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, of course, I was raised as just believing he was a great hero, he was anti-communist, and, you know, the true American patriot. But, of course, you know, we have our icons, we have our heroes, and then, of course, we begin to find out that our heroes really aren't heroes at all. And there were many, many strange things about J. Edgar Hoover. Of course, he ran a very, very efficient organization. But he ran it with an iron fist, and he wasn't really worried about obeying the law. He was a very highly placed Mason. He was bisexual. He had a lover. I'm sure you've talked to Madeline Duncan Brown about him, and, of course, his sexual proclivity. And yet, of course, he would not tolerate homosexuality among his employees. And yet, of course, he always traveled with his very special friend. Did you get into that at all?
I talk about it a little bit, but I was more interested in his criminal acts rather than his personal acts. But Madeline did talk about J. Edgar Hoover and Clad Tolson, who came to Dallas often, and they would go to an island off of Matagorda and... all homosexual leaders at the time, and they'd spend maybe the entire week over there.
And, of course, J. Edgar Hoover's, one of his closest friends was Roy Cohn, who was a very notorious homosexual who died of AIDS. And, of course, it was Roy Cohn who did so much to discredit Joe McCarthy. He was the aide to Joe McCarthy and doing all these stupid things. I never could understand why he was so stupid until I began to understand that maybe his purpose was to totally discredit other people. But, of course, he was certainly one of Hoover's closest friends. So we began to see this pattern unfolding. Now, certainly Hoover was able to stay in office from administration to administration. When did he first get into office? Was it really under Roosevelt or before?
I don't remember the date, but he was in there something like 40 or 50 years, and he was supposed to have retired at age 70, I believe, by law, and Kennedy, John Fisher Kennedy, was going to make him retire because he had passed the age, and that's just before Kennedy was killed, and after Johnson took over, he wrote an executive order saying that Hoover could be in office as long as he wanted to.
And so he remained in office until his death. But really, of course, the FBI was violating the law under Hoover, weren't they?
Yes.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit more about, of course, how they actually discredited Martin Luther King, and of course, why they simply wanted to discredit him because he was leading the civil rights movement, or was there another agenda behind that?
Well, the civil rights and the Vietnam War, he was speaking out against it, and the elite international bankers made tremendous amounts of profits off of wars, and so they deliberately extended the Vietnam War as long as they could because...
Well, of course, even more than the profit, why the war was used to change America. And if you read the writings of McGeorge Bundy in the January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, he says the road forward at home, anybody who believes in the great new departures in health and education and welfare, who believes in the cause of true equality, shouldn't say we ought to get out of Vietnam, for exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. And if we were to pull out of Vietnam, why, of course, it'd be tremendous reaction against our domestic policies. So Vietnam was used to socialize America, to cover for the Supreme Court as it took God and prayer out of our schools, as they changed our immigration laws, leaving us open for what's happened with September 11th And, of course, by opening up our immigration laws so you couldn't control terrorists coming into this country, why, of course, you assured that there would be instability in the future. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson centralized all power in Washington, D.C. Vietnam was a very effective cover for an entirely different agenda, which most people don't understand. And although a lot of profit was made, there was another agenda behind it, because McGeorge Bundy was one of the leaders of this little clique, Skull and Bones Council on Foreign Relations, the group that truly rules America.
Drugs was another byproduct of Vietnam. Before Vietnam, there was almost unnoticeable amount of drugs in the United States, and the American soldiers being over there that were exposed to the drugs, and of course the CIA made a lot of money off of drugs, and so that really was the beginning of the drug war that is taking place today in the United States.
Of course, the drug war really is not fought against drugs; it's fought against the American people. In other words,
yes, that's right.
That's why we have so many people in prison now. You know, what most Americans don't understand is that today there are 6.5 million people either in prison, on probation, or on parole in America. And, of course, almost half of the young blacks are in prison, probation, or parole. And, of course, what better way to destroy a nation than to flood it with drugs? And the CIA is certainly the largest drug producer and a provider in the United States. And it could not be done without, of course, the full knowledge of people in key positions. But, and, of course, we remember, of course, who was the head of the CIA? Well, from 76 to 79, it was a man named George Herbert Walker Bush. That was before he became the vice president, of course. And then, of course, he really ran the Reagan administration and then the next administration and so forth. For 12 years, he really controlled the executive branch of government, and today his son controls the executive branch of government. Both men, of course, as was the predecessor Prescott Bush, coming from the occult Skull and Bone Society. Well, now, of course, the significant thing is that this was all brought out in a Senate hearing. And, of course, the average American never heard what that Senate hearing revealed, did they?
No, and very few people are aware that they even existed. And a friend of mine said, I think I've got something that you'd be interested in. And she sent me these three volumes, and I got to going through them. And I said, that's really the answer to the King killing.
We need to get that up on the Internet, and if we perhaps could talk to you off the air and see how we can possibly do that. It's so vitally important that the information is available to the American people. Joyce Riley has recently actually put up on her website the entire report put out by Senator Riegel, which was the investigation of how Saddam Hussein got his chemical and biological weapons that were used, of course, during the Gulf War to create and probably at least in part responsible for the Gulf War illness. And, of course, cost Senator Riegel his seat in the Senate, you know, because the establishment didn't want that information out. But the American people need to have access to the original reports. And most of these investigations, government investigations, are simply suppressed by the media. So I'm excited at the fact that you actually got that report and have made it available. Now, is there anything else in that report that we ought to talk about, or maybe we can get into the background of the assassination of Martin Luther King, who did it, what you actually discovered about the people who committed the crime, and how they framed James Earl Ray, who you'd actually talked to on a number and spent some time with him shortly before he died, didn't you?
Yes, that's correct. But before we get into that, my dear friend Joyce Riley is the one that provided me with those three volumes.
Okay. Well, of course, you know, it's amazing how, you know, this small little group of people on the front lines of this battle work
right.
Very close together.
But the if you'd like to get into the King killing, that really it started back when a fellow named Nick, or his code name was Raoul. He was either CIA or FBI. I hadn't found out for sure, but the only name we have is Raoul. But Raoul invited James Earl Ray to come to Memphis on a gun deal. And so James did meet Raoul there at, in front of Jim's Grill across the street from the Lorraine Hotel. And
We're going to have to take a quick break here.
Okay.
And so we got 3 minutes. If you'd like to get a cup of coffee or a drink of water, okay?
All right.
We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to us, either in the great state of Washington or northeastern Oregon or western Idaho, we hope that many of you will decide right now you want to join the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day and on our weekend programs as well. And we're heard in about 50 outlets across America at the present time, including, of course, satellite and internet and shortwave, but about 2 hours a day on shortwave and 3 hours on satellite and 5 hours on radio. And our weekend program is heard, 40 stations have our weekend program. And of course, it's so vitally important that we are a voice that's going to get the information out you're not going to get from the controlled media. So if you believe there's a problem, if you believe behind what's going on there are spirits or forces, and you'd like to at least do something and be part of an organization that's on the front lines of this battle, we hope many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family. And it's as simple as just picking up your telephone and calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, sometimes, you know, it's hard for an individual to do a lot. We do it. God's given us the opportunity and given us a microphone and perhaps given us the ability to talk 5 hours a day, especially when, of course, we're expecting a guest and he doesn't show up. Sometimes that's a little embarrassing, but you can't have dead air, and so you simply carry on a intelligent discourse until somebody calls in. But we do this. We do it because we feel that without knowledge, this country will be lost. We believe that there has been a spiritual battle for the souls of men since the beginning of time. We believe America was created as a Christian nation, but at the same time, there were dark and sinister occult organizations and spiritual forces here. And, of course, the Christian influence was predominant until the 1930s, when, of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a highly placed Mason, packed the Supreme Court with Masons and put the occult symbol of the mystery religions on the back of the dollar bill. And you'll find it there, of course, the pyramid topped by the all-seeing eye. And, of course, that had been placed on the back of the Great Seal of the United States in 1787, something like that. Anyway, the information is all available through our ministry. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, and you can request either August or September. August deals with the Oklahoma City bombing, and September deals with, of course, the attack on the World Trade Center. Who funded it? Who financed the Islamic terrorist movement? And where America's headed? And why? Why, of course, that's the September newsletter. It'll be a week or two before that's available. But we hope that many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family. If you'd like a free copy of the newsletter and haven't had one before, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Tell your friends about our program. Tell them about our website at radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope many of you will join in this epic struggle to determine if this nation or any nation conceived under God and freedom can long endure. Well, this is Arthur Stan. Our guest this evening is Galen Ross. His book, The Elite Serial Killers of Lincoln, JFK, RFK, and MLK. That's The Elite Serial Killers of Lincoln, JFK, RFK, and MLK. And, of course, if you want any more information on the book, why, of course, you can call our 800 number and they can tell you a suggested donation. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But right now, We're going to get back to Galen Ross, and he's going to tell us about Raoul. And, of course, this was the story that I can remember that was brought out at the time when they had their patsy. His name was James Earl Ray. Now, they knew he wasn't guilty, but they sent him to prison when he died there, really, in just a year or so ago. But, of course, they needed somebody, you know, to blame the murder of Martin Luther King on, because the last thing they wanted was to end the war in Vietnam. After all, it was serving a very useful purpose. It was a cover for many of the things we've already talked about. But the major thing was, how are we going to change America forever? Because wars are used not to defeat an enemy, because we didn't defeat the enemy in Southeast Asia. Wars are fought to change nations. And, of course, as Colonel House had said so well in 1923, shortly after the conclusion of the First World War, great changes seldom materializes without violent upheavals. Great changes seldom materialize without violent upheavals. That was from an article in the Foreign Affairs magazine in June of 1923. And, of course, the quotation can be found in Dennis Cuddy's excellent book, Secret Records Revealed. So go ahead then, Galen, why don't you tell us about Raoul and of course, what led up to the assassination of Martin Luther King, who did it, and, of course, how they were able to cover that, and then, of course, eventually convict James Earl Ray for a murder he did not commit, and the government knew he didn't commit it, and they sent him to prison anyway.
Okay, so Raoul told James to go to the gun shop and pick up a rifle with a telescope sight on it, and so he got his car and went over to the gun shop and brought it back, and Raoul looked at it and says, "You idiot, this is the wrong caliber. You got a 243, you need to get a 30-06. So go back and change it." So James took the rifle back to the same gun shop and swapped it for a 30-06 with a scope on it and brought it back. And so he was, according to the records, he went up to the second floor of the flop house above Jim's Grill, and with his feet standing on the side of the lips of the bathtub, took aim from a window and shot Martin Luther King. Now, the Associated Press in their archives, there's a photograph taken from that same window within just hours from the shooting, showing trees, large bushes in the way. They didn't have leaves on them, but the limbs were secured the view of King from that position. And it wasn't long after that that the Public Works Department came in and cut down all those trees because they didn't want the public to know that there was not a good shot from that window. And but that is on the archives of the Associated Press in their files. But there's a fellow named Lloyd Jowers owned Jim's Grill below where James was supposed to have been. And at the time of the shooting, Lloyd Jowers had a black lady working as a waitress in his cafe, and her name was Betty Scaife. And when she heard the shot, she went into the kitchen. She thought something blew up in the kitchen, and just as she entered the kitchen, Lloyd Jowers entered from the back door carrying a rifle. And so he shut the door and told her to get back up front and wait on the customers. And so she left, and so he ejected the cartridge and the shell case and bent it on the countertop and threw it in the commode and flushed it, and it stopped up the commode. And so he had to fish it out, and he washed it off, put it in his pocket, and later threw it in the Mississippi River. But the rifle he broke down and wrapped it in a tablecloth and put it on the counter, and later hid it. And as just before the shot was fired, James Earl Ray was going to his Mustang, and he heard a shot, and so he just got in his Mustang and went driving off because he was an escaped convict at the time. Now, he was a habitual criminal. His entire family were criminals. His father was escaped convict from the penitentiary in Oregon, and his brother Jerry had been involved in a number of petty crimes, and But at the time, James was an escaped convict, and so when he heard the shot, escaped convicts get away from the point where there's any firing weapons going on. And so he drove off, but there, let me stop here for a second. There was a fellow named Jim Green who was brought in by Raoul with the assignment to kill James Earl Ray. Jim Green was on top of a building, and he was positioned where he was going to shoot James as he came out of a particular door. He thought that's where he'd be coming out. But
sure, sort of like Ruby shooting Oswald. Then.
That's correct.
Patsy. Right.
But when James came out, he came out a different door, and Green was not prepared to shoot at that time. So by the time he repositioned himself to take aim, James had already gotten his Mustang and driven away, and he didn't get a shot at him. But he followed him to Atlanta, to airport where James got on a plane and flew to Toronto, and Green took the next flight and missed him by an hour in Toronto, where he took a flight to London, and from there went to Portugal, stayed in Portugal a week or two, and then went back to London and ran out of money. And I interviewed James in prison about 2 weeks before he died. I was probably one of the last people to interview him. And I drove over to the prison with his brother Jerry, and so I had an opportunity to talk to Jerry for about 2 hours before we got there, and then had a long discussion with James Earl Ray, and James told me the story about he was forced to confess. They told him that they knew where his father was, and that they were going to pick him up and put him back in prison and probably put him in solitary confinement the rest of his life, and that they were going to brand his brother Jerry as being Raoul and implicate him in the shooting as a co-conspirator and put him in prison for the rest of his life, and that they would find James guilty and sentence him to death. And so his attorney told him that his only out was to confess and that they wouldn't kill him. And they wouldn't pick up his father, and they wouldn't brand his brother as being Raoul. And so he did confess in court. And the very next day, he went to his attorney and said he really needed to recall that confession because it was not true, and for several years he tried to get a new trial to get that confession thrown out, and of course they had their man and they didn't want the truth to come out, and so they never allowed him to go to back into court.
Now, of course, there were a couple of things. I understand that initially they put him in a cell and they kept the lights on all the time and they keep waking him up all the time to make sure he didn't commit suicide. So didn't they use this sleep deep deprivation technique on him to disorient him?
Yeah, the CIA was great at mind control, and so I'm sure they used a lot of their techniques on James.
And I remember very well, of course, when James Earl Ray pleaded guilty, and then, of course, the judge's name was Judge Battle. And, of course, a couple of days later, James Earl Ray came back and said, you know, I was talked into this. I want another trial. And Judge Battle said, all right, we'll give you another trial. And then one of the most amazing things, Judge Battle died about a day later of a massive heart attack or something or other. And then the next judge who came on the trial, took over the case, was not about to allow James Earl Ray to have a second trial. Do you remember, did you get into that at all?
No, I didn't, but I know that Judge Joe Brown was supposed to be one of the sitting judges for James's retrial, and they were afraid that Joe Brown would bring out the truth, and so they took Judge Joe Brown off the case.
Now, what about how this Green fellow, this story that you told, that he was supposed to kill James Earl Ray as he was coming out. How did you get that story, and where's the verification of that?
He appeared at the COPA meeting, I believe it was last year, and had the supposed rifle with him that was used to shoot King. I don't believe it was, in fact, I know it was not the right rifle, but he produced a compact disc with his story on it and told of the history leading up to it and after the killing.
Well, I would think that would be pretty hazardous for his health. Is he still alive, do you know?
Yes, he's still alive and been arrested.
Now, is there any way we could possibly get, do you have a telephone number we could get him and get him on the program?
I can probably run that down for you.
Okay, I think that would be important. Well, right now, of course, we've got Nathan on the line, so let's get Nathan's question. But then I really want to get, of course, to what happened, how they actually found James Earl Ray. And then, of course, Nathan, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, it's a comment that's going to turn into a question, and I'll take it off the air. I noticed something that is rather interesting. You go, you start with, let's start with Andrew Jackson. He was almost assassinated. Lincoln was assassinated. We'll jump all the way up to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. I'm blanking on all the names, but you look at them, most of them, frankly, have been people who have questioned certain deeply vested interests.
Well, of course, there was McKinley, of course, and then there was, I've forgotten another one in the interim, of course, Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, right.
Well, now, Jackson was questioning the money interest.
Right.
He also was in trouble with Calhoun and the slave power because he wasn't doing their bidding 100%. King was challenging the repression in the South. Kennedy was supposedly questioning the money power, from what I've heard. And there's also been the claim that he was going to pull us out of Vietnam. So I'm looking at this, and this is rather interesting. But I also believe there's a deeper phenomenon at work, and I'm going to let your guest address it, and I'll take my answer off the air. I believe that there are, of course, the laws of God, and there are the laws that that this society is supposed to follow. And I think that there are, as Dr. Stan said, evil forces that have conspired against that. I agree with him to a large extent on the conspiracy issue and with Dr. Stan's guest on the conspiracy issue, but I also think that there are actual spiritual forces that really do work through human agency. And I think that people who come too close to the truth or too close to the light are going to get powerful opposition from Satan, basically, to put it bluntly.
Right.
And I'd like to have your guest comment on that.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Nathan. And what would your response be to Nathan, Caleb?
Well, a number of people asked me who's behind all of this evil. And first of all, I named the Rothschilds and Rockefellers. And they said, but if it's one person, who would you name? And I said, well, it's not a person, and it's a being, it's a non-being called Lucifer.
Right, because I think that that is what Nathan is referring to. This is a satanic conspiracy, but certainly Satan and his minions work through individuals. And, of course, what we see are the cause and effect. We don't necessarily always understand what's going on behind the scenes, but there's always been a conspiracy against God. Jeremiah 11:9, Ezekiel 22:25. There's always been a conspiracy against God, 2 Psalm. And we're seeing it played out today. But what you've done is a great job, and, of course, getting this whole thing out now. Of course, they time and time again, the James Earl Ray tried to get a new trial, and actually the King family, Martin Luther King's family, finally came to understand that, you know, this whole thing was a setup, didn't they? In fact, didn't they actually come out and ask for a new trial for James Earl Ray?
Yes, that's correct, and I believe Dr. Pepper was going to be the one to try to get that going, and he was never successful, but The King family are absolutely convinced that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with it, and I discussed that with Bernice King last weekend, and that's when she told me that my book had finally given her peace and had answered all of her questions that had been bothering her all of her life.
Well, you know, this is that's one nice thing about writing a book. If you can just touch even one person's life with that book, well, it makes it all worthwhile. And I'm sure your book has touched a lot of people's lives and answered a lot of questions about this continuity of certainly of assassinations, and there are lots more, but you've just simply hit on four of the most important ones. And of course, you've done a tremendous, tremendous amount of research going into the background of who killed Kennedy, how this was done, who was involved, how they did it. And of course, there's no way that this could be done without the full cooperation of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Central Intelligence Agency. Is that true?
That's correct. And in the book, I give their direct involvement in all three killings. And and I guess the two Senate hearings back in the 70s confirm all of this, because it's very clear if you read all those documents that the CIA and the FBI were not here to protect us, but to take advantage of us.
Well, you know, of course, there's a book we have. It's called Redecide. It's written by Mr. Douglas. But he, of course, has some information that comes from out of the CIA. But he was commenting that, of course, Mr. Sullivan was the go-between between the FBI. He was assistant director of the FBI, second only to J. Edgar Hoover, and the liaison then to the CIA. Mr. Sullivan was the liaison to the CIA. And, of course, there was a falling out between Mr. Hoover and Mr. Sullivan. Now, Mr. Sullivan knew an awful lot. He quit the FBI and went out on his front porch, and somebody shot him thinking he was a deer. And, of course, he could never then discuss what he knew with anybody else. So sometimes I think it's probably a little bit dangerous to be in these key positions in these cover-ups, because, of course, everybody who's involved is potential informant, and they have to be eliminated one at a time.
Yeah, William Kobe's another example of that.
Right.
He was director of the CIA, and he had his lunch on the table, and everything was set out so that he could eat, and all of a sudden he just decided to go out and get in his canoe and row down out the lake.
Right, right. And I think it was rather bad weather, but for some reason he wanted to get in that canoe.
Yes.
And, of course, unfortunately, Mr. Colby drowned. And it's said that he was writing his memoirs and he was going to expose a lot of these things.
That's correct.
In fact, of all the people in the CIA, he seemed to have been one of the better ones. Did you have that impression?
Yes. He was fixing to expose him. And that's the reason they had to take him out.
And, ladies and gentlemen, this sounds pretty dramatic, but unfortunately, this is the way the world really works today. And, of course, we're moving into a great war in the Middle East that I believe is going to change everybody's lives. And, of course, they've got to get into this war as quickly as possible, because I believe people across America are beginning to wake up. But once we get into the war, it'll be unpatriotic to speak out against the president or to even ask the question, why did our intelligence agencies not try to stop the attack on the World Trade Center? And, of course, you should hear what's coming out in these hearings back in Washington, D.C., totally blacked out in your local newspaper. But we're going to have copies of those committee hearings available to our ministry very, very soon. We already have the Volume 1, the first report, but there's six of them now completed. It'll be available through Radio Liberty in the near future. And you'll be amazed. You know, as one of the FBI agents sits weeping before this committee saying, I told them somebody's going to die. Why won't you let me investigate these known terrorists? Two of them, of course, were on the plane that crashed into the Pentagon, but the FBI would not allow him to investigate. Or the agent who talked about Zacharias Moussaoui and said, you know, if we let him go, he may very well get in a plane and crash into the World Trade Center. And yet our high official said, gee, we had no idea there was going to be an attack on the World Trade Center. Golly gee, they just really fooled us, these fellows. And, of course, they had people in this whole movement. They knew everything they were doing. They were monitoring it, and they did nothing, absolutely nothing to stop it. And if you doubt that we had infiltrated Al-Qaeda, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a copy of the USA Today that, of course, tells that they had people in Al-Qaeda, and they knew that they were going to fly into the World Trade Center, and they knew they were going to hijack our planes. But, of course, you're not getting that in your local newspaper. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like that June 4th USA Today front page article covering, of course, the material the CIA had turned over to the intelligence committee and never mentioned by the controlled media. Well, shall we go on to, is there anything else we should cover for Martin Luther King, or do you want to get into the assassination of John Kennedy?
Well, I guess we pretty well covered that.
Basically, they caught James Earl Ray in London because he tried to commit another crime. Was that it?
Yeah, he asked James, why did he get caught in London? He said it was very simple. He completely ran out of money, and he had to commit a minor crime and was caught in the act, and they found out he was wanted, and so they extradited him.
All right, and how did he have enough money to make the getaway?
He was a habitual criminal, and I don't know how, where he got his money to fly to Toronto and then London and Portugal.
Where did he get his passport? Didn't somebody up in Canada help him get the passport?
I don't know the details of that, I didn't really think to ask James about that.
I remember there was a story about somebody was on a radio, and they were announcing that this white whatever the car was, this white was white Mustang.
Yeah, it was a Mustang.
Well, it was Mustang. White Mustang was taking off, and you know, somebody was obviously monitoring every move he made.
Well, yeah, they followed him all the way to Atlanta.
Right.
They could arrest him on the way, but they didn't.
All right, fine. Well, of course, then let's get on into the assassination of President Kennedy. We don't have much time before we have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, but people out across America will be able to hear the entire story of the assassination of John Kennedy, because you have actually done a great deal of work on this, and you've even talked to some people who were intimately involved with the planning of this, didn't you?
That's correct. And it really, the assassination of JFK sort of goes back to the 1960 presidential campaign or the convention, where H.L. Hunt and Joe Kennedy were trying to put their man at the head of the ticket, and for some reason Joe won out, and so Joe said, we'll let Lyndon be the second man. And so when...
And H.L. Hunt wanted, of course, Lyndon to be the first man, right.
That's right. And so when H.L. came back to Dallas, my dear friend Madeline Duncan Brown shared a parking lot with the building that Hunt officed in. And she met him in the parking lot and said, well, H.L., what'd you think about the convention? And he said, Madeline, we lost a battle, but we hadn't lost a war.
Now, if anybody would like to hear my interviews with Madeline Duncan Brown, who was Lyndon Johnson's mistress for 20-some years, why, of course, that's in our Kennedy assassination update. It's a fascinating, fascinating interview with a fascinating lady. And whether we approve of her lifestyle, the thing is that she really was a witness to history, and we're indebted to her for what she's been able to tell us about the plans that were made, and, of course, they involved her lover, Lyndon Baines Johnson. So why don't you probably tell us, we've only got about, we've not got time to get into that. So if our listeners want any more information, we will have a next hour's tape, and they can always call and get a copy of that if they'd like. But right now, of course, we want to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and, of course, to encourage them to be listening tomorrow when we're back, and to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But right now we have with us Galen Ross, and we're going to go into the background of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Pardon me, the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And, of course, really it all starts, the understanding of it starts with Madeleine Duncan Brown's story of the meeting that was held the night before the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963. Go ahead and pick up the story there, Galen.
Okay. It really goes back to about 1995 when Madeleine Brown she published a book titled Texas in the Morning. And I don't remember the exact date she published it, but I met her shortly after that and became an investor in the book. And so then I was lucky enough to be able to meet Madeleine, and we became friends and became very close friends. And in her book, she talks about a meeting that took place in Clint Ferguson's home, North Dallas, on the evening of November the 21st, 1963. And and I would probably meet with Madeleine every 4 to 6 weeks. And over a period of time, we got more into this meeting. And finally, one day, she said, Galen, I think I can trust you. I think I can tell you the whole truth, tell you the whole story. And she did that, and she was willing to do that on videotape. And I was, I guess, in a way, lucky to be able to do that because Madeleine passed away June 20th of this year. And it was a sorrowful passing because she was a wealth of knowledge of many things that transpired during those days, particularly about Johnson and Kennedy and the people of those times. But she said that she was invited to attend this social event at Clint Ferguson's home on the evening before Kennedy was killed. And the purpose of the meeting was to honor J. Edgar Hoover, who was in town. And so J. Edgar Hoover was there. And there were a total of 45 people attended this social event. And 20 of these people were members of the media. And Madeleine was there because any time that Johnson was supposed to be at any event in Texas, they always arranged for her to be there because she was his mistress for 21 years. She gave birth to his only known son, Stephen. But Madeleine didn't know that Johnson was going to be there that night. She was, because she was close with Hodd and Ferguson and many of the wealthy people at the time, she was always invited to these events. And so about somewhere between 1 and 1:30 in the morning, the social was about to break up, and the front door opened, and Lyndon Johnson walked in. And so Ferguson said, okay, men, now we can have our meeting. And so 25 men went into the conference room, closed the door, and met for 15 to 20 minutes. And a fellow named Cliff Carter was actually running the meeting. And Cliff Carter was Johnson's, one of his left-hand men. And Cliff actually helped in many of the killings that Johnson wanted done. And most of the killings that Cliff assigned the job to were done, assigned to a fellow named Mac Wallace. Malcolm E. Mac Wallace. And
Was that one of those that friend of Johnson's who committed suicide with a single action rifle by shooting himself five times or something?
He shot himself in the side with a 22 caliber bolt action rifle. Before that, he had hit himself in the head, and he was still conscious, so he got a hose, put it in the exhaust pipe of the truck, and put it in the window of the cab and sat in there for a while, and it didn't seem to be killing him soon enough, so he got out and got this bolt-action 22 rifle from the back of the gun rack and then the cab of the truck and laid down on the ground and shot himself five times.
Shot himself five times with a single-action rifle. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, committed suicide.
And, of course, the police confirmed it was a suicide because
yes.
What else could it be with a single-action rifle?
That's right. And it took about a year for the Marshall family to get that overturned from suicide to homicide. And but they were able to do that. By then, it was Johnson had died and Mac Walsh was no longer living and a fellow named Billy Saul Estes appeared at this hearing, and he was instrumental in proving that it was a murder.
Billy Saul Estes, huh?
Yes.
He was very, very well known during the Johnson administration.
Yes.
He's still alive?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
Yeah, he's an acquaintance of mine.
Okay.
But back to the social event, when these four men went behind the closed doors. I'll name just a few of the people that were there. Clint Merksem, Sr., H.L. Hunt was there. Leonard Johnson, of course, was there. A fellow named John J. McCloy was there. At that time, he was chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank and chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the secret organizations that I write about. And so that's how I tie the elite into this. Richard Nixon was also there, and of course, Jared Hoover and his boy mate, Clyde Tolson, was there. Also, John Conley was there, and there were three members of the Mafia that attended this event. One of them was a fellow named Carlos Marcello, who headed up the Mafia in New Orleans. So you have the director of the director of the FBI in a closed-door meeting with members of the Mafia and members of the wealthy oil barons.
But that really shouldn't be too surprising because, of course, Hoover never went after the Mafia until he was embarrassed into doing it by the Kennedy boys. He never forgave them for forcing him to go after the Mafia, and of course, Hoover established a system of giving free rides to members of the Mafia who would inform, and whole concept I think is still going on today. They have this process: if you will inform on the Mafia, why, you can kill, murder, do whatever you want to. That's what this whole situation in Boston was. The book we carry called Deadly Alliance, the alliance between the FBI and the Mafia. So why should anybody be surprised he was there with the Mafia back in 1963?
Well, in fact, in several Senate hearings, Hoover said right on TV camera that there's no such thing as a Mafia. And,
apparently they had information about his homosexuality, and so he simply covered for them for many years.
That's right. In fact, Hoover was the king of keeping records on people. Johnson was his neighbor for about 20 years there in Washington, and they both had goods on one another, so they'd stand back to back and take on anybody. Because,
and they were both Masons, too.
Yes. But back to this meeting, Cliff Carter asked a question, what about the evidence? And Hoover spoke up and said, don't worry about the evidence. All evidence must come through the FBI, and I've got it wired. Now, how would I know these statements? A fellow that was also in this secret meeting is what I call my deep throat. He was there, and he was also in the Texas Scuba Depository building the next day, and so I have the testimony from eyewitnesses to all this is going on.
And, of course, this then goes right along with what Madeleine Duncan Brown told you as well.
Yes,
in
that's
words,
right.
She told you he was there, and he told you what happened in the meeting. Is that it?
That's correct. And also, I've interviewed a member of the press that was also at this meeting that confirmed the names of the people that attended this event.
Now, he never has revealed to you what was said at the meeting, or?
This member of the press was not, he didn't go into the secret meeting.
Okay, fine.
But being told, he confirmed the attendees of the meeting.
Okay.
My deep throat is the only one that was involved in the secret meeting, and he's the only one, that, well, no, there are two people still alive that were in that secret meeting.
Okay, fine. And why did your deep throat tell you what happened? Did he have pangs of conscience? Did he want the
letter? No, somehow he got a copy of my first book, Who's Who of the Elite, and so I met him one day by accident, and well, I say it was an accident. It's probably on purpose on his part, because he made a statement shortly after we met because of my work in Who's Who the Elite, that he thought he could trust me, and that he wanted to get the truth out on the grounds that I would keep his name confidential, and I swore that I would do that.
Okay. So, of course, you won't release his name until after he's gone. And
well, if he's given immunity from prosecution by the U.S. Justice Department or the Congress and gives me permission to give his name, then I'll do that. Otherwise, his name will never come out of me.
Well, I'm sure that the U.S. Justice Department does not want the truth to come out. It would be very embarrassing to realize that our intelligence agency, both the FBI and the CIA, have been involved in all of these assassinations. And that would almost give some people reason not to trust the government.
I've met with six members of Congress on this subject, and hoping that they would hold hearings, and have not been successful yet. I'm not giving up. I'm still hoping that something will come out of this, but meeting with members of Congress, you'd think they'd say, oh, we got the truth, let's get the truth out. And
I think that many of them may very well fear for their lives. They know what happened to Congressman
very well,
Hansen,
yes,
when he tried to get the truth out, and of course, they can make. They've just went after Traficant. I don't know whether he was guilty or not, but certainly they targeted him for things probably far less than Bill Clinton was. I mean, here's Bill Clinton got $10 million for a book he's never written. Has anybody read Bill Clinton's book or Hillary Clinton's book? She got $8 million. Have you ever read her book? No, of course not. The books are not even written, and they've got the money. Bill Clinton got $10 million in speaking fees last year, including $250,000 for going to China to give a 30-minute speech. This gives corruption a bad name. Go ahead.
They also took out a dear friend of mine, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. They actually had the Republicans in her district vote in the Democratic primary against her, and she lost because she got most of the Democratic votes, but she lost because of the Republican votes.
Right. Well, of course.
And they took her out because she was speaking out about the foreknowledge of the Twin Tower.
No, that's not to be allowed, of course.
That's right.
Well, let's get then back to the meeting. So the
okay.
meeting here is the 21st of November, 1963, and there are these 20 men there. You've mentioned John.
25 men.
Okay, and go ahead with the story.
Okay, so they made sure, and the purpose of this particular meeting was to make sure that there was absolute cover-up of the assassination that was supposed to take place the next day. And so let's talk about the next day. In the morning, as Johnson came out of this meeting, he went over to Madeleine and leaned over, and she thought he was going to say, I'll meet you at the hotel at a certain time or whatever. But what he really said was, Madeleine, after tomorrow, that blankety-blank Kennedy will never embarrass me again. That's not a threat. That's a promise. And so the next morning, while he was still in Fort Worth, he called her again and made the same or similar statement that Kennedy was going to pay for it. And on the back of my book, I've got a picture of Lyndon Johnson sneering at Kennedy while he's talking, and sort of the expression on Johnson's face is that, say what you want to, fella, but in 2 hours you're going to be dead. And, but on the day of the killing, the Warren Commission says that Lee Harvey Oswald was a single shooter, fired 3 shots from the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and one of the bullets was a magic bullet that went through Kennedy, and then after the exit, his body, it took a right turn and went down and hit John Connally a couple of times and lay pristine on the floor. Of course, that defies some major laws of physics. But Arnold Specter generated that magic bullet theory, and he's an attorney, and he obviously knows very little about physics.
I think he probably knows everything. He was assistant counsel for the Warren Commission. He was very well rewarded for his treachery. He is now Senator Arlen Specter.
That's correct.
Incidentally, one of the Republicans who voted with the Democrats against the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
But now, instead of being a single shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald, there was a death squad of 15 people. And the reason I say people, because there's one female involved. But behind the picket fence on a grassy knoll, there was two shooters and one radio operator. And behind the motorcade, Kennedy's car, on the 2nd floor of the Dowtex building, there was one shooter and one radio operator. And on top of the Dallas County Records building, there was one shooter and one radio operator. This particular shooter was a deputy sheriff for the Dallas County Sheriff's Department that was there to not protect the president, but to help kill him.
Now, wasn't the sheriff involved in this whole thing?
No. Let me take that back. The sheriff was in one of the attendees at the Clint Murchison meeting. His name was Bill Decker. Decker was in that Clint Murchison meeting, so he was directly involved.
Okay.
But on the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository building, there were two shooters, Lee Harvey Oswald and a Hispanic lady named Ruth Ann, who operated the radio. Now, Ruth Ann is the only one of the shooters, the shooting team, that's still alive, and she's about 57 years of age now.
57?
She was 20 at the time.
Oh, I see. Well, okay.
So it's 59.
Okay.
But she's the only one that could tell us whether Lee Harvey Oswald even was even near a gun that day. But
is there any way to reach her? Is she in communication?
Well, I'm not sure about her last name, and so I can't use her last name until I'm absolutely sure, but I'm convinced she's still alive. And if she were given absolutely immunity from prosecution, I feel she might come forward.
Okay, fine. So anyway, so you have these people in several locations, 15 people, and they're going to kill the president. And, of course, they all have radios, so they're in constant contact with one another.
Yes, and on the 2nd floor of the Texas School Book Depository was a command center, and there was Cliff Carter on the radio giving the orders to fire, and there were 4 people on the 2nd floor. And so when he gave the order to fire, all the radio operators immediately echoed the fire, and instead of 3 shots, there were about 6 shots were fired at within about a 3 or 4 second period of time. And
but of course, they had to convince the American people that it was Lee Harvey Oswald. He got off 3 quick shots, 2 of which hit the president, and 1 hit the curb. But of course, there was evidence of so many shots, weren't there?
Yes, and also one fellow's on the 6th floor was the famous Mac Wallace, who was Johnson's number one killer in Texas, and his job was to kill John Connally. And with John Connally being at the Clint Murchison meeting the night before, he knew that there was going to be shooting take place, and so you can imagine that he was under great stress about that time. In fact, when the shooting started taking place, several witnesses were standing alongside the car at the time, heard Connie say, "My God, they are going to kill us all. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald is not a they." So he knew what was going on, and that was his clue that there was a they instead of a he.
All right, fine. Of course, John Connally did survive. Of course, Connally may have been a threat because he was thinking of running for the presidency. He never really did, but, you know, the president is assassinated. My understanding is that they, you know, after they had to actually detour off the regular route that the president was supposed to take to make a right-hand turn and bring them around in front of the Texas Book Depository, and then didn't the car almost come to a stop before the shots were fired?
Yes, that's true. They were supposed to go straight and go under the railroad bridge and then go to the trademark building for the next meeting, but as they reached the Dealey Plaza, they made a 90-degree turn to the right and went down a block and then made a 120-degree turn to the left. And in order for this long limousine to make that wide-angle turn, it came almost to a stop. And so by the time the Lincoln reached the point where most of the shots took place, it was only doing about 10 or 12 miles an hour. So the shooter that blew the top of Kennedy's head off was behind a picket fence, and so that gave him plenty of time to take aim and to make a very deadly shot that blew his head off.
Well, ordinarily, of course, the Secret Service, you know, if they know the president's going to come in, they come in, they weld all the manholes closed, they have people on the top of every building, they make sure that all the windows are shut. Where was the Secret Service, or were they involved in this whole thing as well?
Well, it just so happens that the night before, there was a gathering of the Secret Service in a place called the Cellar in Fort Worth that started early in the evening and went on till about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and most of the Secret Service attended this, and they had free liquor and free women all evening, and so the purpose was to make them inept that day. Instead of protecting the president, they were sort of out of it.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty good technique. And, of course, you neutralize the Secret Service. But, I would have thought even the military would have been there. Ordinarily, the president has maximum protection. And it seems that they didn't have much protection for him that day. And why they would have, of course, gone off the regular route to have made those turns, which have made him obviously an excellent, a target. Well, nobody ever really asked that question, did they?
No, that's it. And in fact, Ralph Yarborough was in the car with Lyndon Johnson and three other cities that had been in Texas just before this. Ralph refused to ride in a car with Lyndon, but Kennedy talked him into riding with him on this day. But Ralph says that at the time, just before the shooting, he looked over and Johnson had a walkie-talkie radio crammed in his ear, leaning up against the window, listening to the command of fire.
Okay, fine. So, of course, then the president is shot, and he's rushed off to Parkland Hospital. And then, of course, the FBI apparently went around, and anybody who said they saw, heard more than three shots or saw something coming, the shots coming from the grassy knoll, didn't the FBI pretty well cover that and say, who didn't see what you think you saw or things like that?
Yeah, and in fact, the FBI issued instructions to the Kodak film developing company that all films that were submitted for developing during that time were to be submitted to the FBI for review before they would be given to the people that took the photographs.
Well, boy, they weren't going to take a chance on anybody getting any evidence, were they?
That's right.
So the whole idea was, of course, to control access to information. And you have the FBI involved, you have the CIA involved, and there's no other way that this could have happened and been covered up without the complicity of John Edgar Hoover and, of course, of the Central Intelligence Agency at the time.
Yes, the CIA actually brought the rifles to Dallas that were used in the killings, and they were not Italian Carcano rifles. They were Mausers, accurized Mausers with scopes on them.
All right.
In fact, there was a meeting at the Cabana Hotel before the meeting at Clint Murchison's, and Richard Nixon headed up that meeting. Nixon was head of an Operation 40 that had been created to assassinate world leaders. And so a number of members of the CIA attended this this meeting at the Cabana Hotel before Nixon went over to Clint Murchison's house.
Good. Nixon.
Most of the CIA left the next morning before the shooting took place.
And of course, Nixon was supposed to have won the election in 1960, and the only reason he didn't was because of the mafia interfering and, of course, fixing the vote in Chicago and Illinois and probably in another state. And that's the only reason, of course, he wasn't the president. I guess he wasn't very happy with Kennedy for that sort of thing.
Yeah, in fact, Joe told the heads of the mafia families if they would support John Kennedy in his race, that he would make sure that the mafia would be immune from any sort of investigation. But he couldn't have his sons follow through with his promise. In fact, they went after the mafia with vigor.
And, of course, the mafia didn't look very kindly on that, you know. It's one thing, you know, to go to the mafia for a favor and to make sure that your son gets to be the president, and then, of course, to have the son turn on the mafia and make their lives miserable, why, that was just downright dishonest. And what about the honor among thieves?
Made the mafia unhappy with him, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit later.
All right. Well, do you think that's why they were they involved? Was the mafia involved in the assassination of Bobby Kennedy?
Yes, they were.
All right. Well,
let's get back to the real reason why John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed.
All right. What was the real reason why he was killed?
Well, there are a number of reasons that have been put forward, but the real reason was that, and we'll just go back to Lincoln. Lincoln needed money to finance Civil War, and his only source of a lot of money were the Rothschilds in London, Paris, Frankfurt, and Switzerland. And they were charging 24% to 36% interest, and so he went to a fellow named Chase, who was Secretary of Treasury, and he told Chase to print money to pay off the debts of the federal government to cover the war. And so Chase actually printed about $450 million worth of what they call greenbacks. And they were successful. Its currency helped finance the war. And so the Rothschilds couldn't stand any fledgling nation to create their own money, because that was their job. They had a monopoly on it. And so that's the reason Lincoln was killed. And so fast forward to June the 4th, 1963, John Fitzgerald Kennedy signed Executive Order 11110, instructing the Treasury Department to print $4.3 billion worth of silver certificates in direct competition with the Federal Reserve. And that's the real reason that John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed. You don't mess with the international bankers' money system.
All right. And, of course, I've seen copies of that executive order. And certainly
it's in my book.
Okay. And I think it's important to realize, of course, that, you know, there were many explanations given. Kennedy wanted to get out of Vietnam. Of course, he wanted to do away with the oil, the police, and the allowance. The communists didn't like him. But I think that there were a lot of people who wanted to get rid of Kennedy. Probably people within the military didn't like him as well. Is that true?
Yes. In fact, he was going to eliminate the CIA. He was going to scatter them to the winds, and he was going to turn the duties of the CIA over to the Defense Department. He had already issued orders to bring the troops back from Vietnam.
Well, of course, it'd be a lot better off if the intelligence was within the military rather than with the Central Intelligence Agency. We're going to have to take a 3-minute, Galen, so why don't you get yourself a cup of coffee, drink of water, and we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you out in the listening audience to help us do what we do as we expand a little bit onto more and more stations across America, trying to get the information, the truth out. So if you're listening to us and you believe there's a problem and you'd like to become part of our team, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV, war. And there are not very many voices out there speaking against this crazy war that they're trying to drag us into. Of course, so many of our so-called Christian leaders are solidly behind the war, and so many of the people are just saying, oh, if the president says it must be true, I've got to back the war. And of course, that's what they said during Vietnam and during Korea and the Desert Storm. And we have to be able to say, you know, you're wrong. And I don't care if Barbara Streisand is against the war and the hippies are against the war. They're absolutely right. Maybe for the wrong reasons. They don't understand. But what they try to do is they get the people we don't like. Barbara Streisand's against the war. And you know what that means. And of course, look at all those people out there demonstrating with the long hair. If they're against the war, we ought to be in favor of it. Don't you understand we're being manipulated? Once you understand that, you know, then, of course, you can begin to think freely. Everything is manipulation. Everything, of course, is perception, having very little to do with reality. Everything is symbolism over substance. And, of course, we have to be able to think independently. And, of course, we need to do everything we can to oppose the war. It would appear that the administration is intent about it, no matter what the American people think. But at least we're a voice. And if you'd like to be part of our voice, consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then please tell others about our radio programs. Tell them about our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. Get our newsletters and read them, and you'll find them. I think that they're fascinating. I always enjoy going back and rereading those newsletters. And then you'll find all sorts of programs archived on our website and a lot of other interesting articles. And, of course, remember our telephone number, 1-800-5-448-927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening, Galen Ross, and we're talking about the Kennedy assassination, and hopefully we're going to get into the JFK assassination, and I should say the RFK assassination here before long. So, Galen, what should we bring up about the Kennedy assassination? Anything else you want to bring up?
I think I said it earlier, but Hoover had over... extended his stay in office beyond the point of retirement, and so JFK was going to make him retire. And of course, just as soon as Johnson took over, he rescinded that and made sure that Hoover could have the job as long as he wanted it. So I think we've pretty well covered the Bobby Kennedy.
All right, fine. Well, let's get into Bobby then.
I mean, John Kennedy.
Right. Well, let's get into Bobby and his assassination. Why did they want to get rid of Bobby? Of course, we know he was would have been a very formidable presidential candidate in 1968. Were there other reasons?
Yeah, there were a number of reasons. One of them was the Carlos Marcello. There had been several Senate hearings where Bobby Kennedy and Carlos actually hollered and shouted at one another and argued on the Senate floor, in the hearing. And so Bobby had been trying to arrest Carlos. But Carlos had fictitious papers from Guatemala allowing him to come into the country. And so Bobby found out about it and So he just one day gathered up Carlos and put him on a plane with his attorney, flew him to Guatemala, and put him on a truck and drove him way off into the jungle and made him get out in their business suits back into the deep jungles, and the truck left. It took quite a while to get back to civilization, and you can imagine every step that Carlos took on the way back, he had some words to say about Bobby. Carlos was directly involved in all three killings.
Well, now, of course, was Carlos he was mafia? Did he have any CIA connections CIA connection?
CIA and the mafia and FBI worked very closely together. They collaborated on many things.
And I think that's really so important for you to understand. And we have a wonderful book. It's called Double Cross, and it's the story of written by the brother of the head of the CIA, talking about how the CIA worked with the mafia. The CIA worked closely with the mafia. In fact, Sam Giancano really felt he could trust the CIA. He even took off and went to other countries to organize the mafia there because he felt he had nothing to worry about here in the United States. And, of course, remember, the book we're talking about this evening is The Elite Serial Killers of Lincoln, JFK, RFK, and MLK by Robert Galen Ross. Excellent, excellent book. Lots of fascinating information. So anyway, we've got Carlos Michel, and he's probably got pretty sore feet and a pretty sore temper. That was an awful thing for Bobby Kennedy. I mean, one thing just to take him into Guatemala, but this is getting personal, isn't it?
Yeah, that Bobby couldn't put him in jail, so he just dropped him off in the jungles. So you can imagine that Carlos was not happy with Bobby. But the other reason was that Bobby knew many of the details behind his brother John's murder, but he was powerless because J. Edgar Hoover was in charge of the FBI and Johnson controlled both houses of Congress. And even though at that time Bobby was attorney general, he had no power. So the only way to get a truthful investigation going was to run for president, and once he's president, then he could force proper hearings. And Johnson, of course, wouldn't allow that. And of course, there was very strong evidence that Bobby would have defeated Johnson in the election. And also, they were afraid that there might be a Kennedy dynasty, that there would be a Kennedy in presidency for many years to come. But that's the main things behind Bobby's killing. But let's go into the details of his killing. He was speaking at a group on June the 5th, 1968 in the Ambassador Hotel on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. And after he finished his campaign speech there in the main ballroom, he was going to a fundraiser, and the quickest way to get to the next meeting was to go through the kitchen of the hotel. So the maitre d', Carl Uger, had him by the hand, leading him through the crowd. There was about 50 people in the pantry at that time. As they got to the steam tables, Carl Uger felt someone nudging him, trying to get around him on the right, and he thought someone was trying to shake Bobby's hand so he didn't get upset. But all of a sudden, Sirhan Sirhan appeared with a .22 revolver, an 8-shot Ira Johnson revolver, and started firing it. Well, Bobby didn't have any Secret Service protect him. The LAPD were not protecting him. No one was there protecting him, but Rafer Johnson, Olympic athlete, and Roosevelt Greer, famous NFL tackle, was there helping or protecting Bobby. And so after Sirhan fired the first shot, Roosevelt grabbed the pistol, grabbed his hand, and started beating it against the steam table. But Sirhan was able to fire all 8 shots. None of them hit Bobby Kennedy, though. of all the people in the pantry that day, no one said that Sirhan got closer than a foot and a half to 2 feet from Bobby and was always in front of him. Now, the Thomas Noguchi Coroner's Report, and I have a copy of the Coroner's Report in my book, and it tells where all the shots came from. They all came from behind Bobby. The first shot pierced the shoulder pads of Bobby's jacket on the right shoulder. The second shot went through his right side under the armpit and exited just above his right shoulder blade. And the third shot was an inch behind his right ear, and the muzzle of the gun was an inch from his head. And the fourth shot entered just below the sixth vertebra in his back. And all these shots came from down below in an upward direction and from very close to Bobby. And the person behind Bobby at that time was a fellow named Thane Eugene Cesar, who was moonlighting with the Ace Security Service at that time. He worked for an aerospace industry during the day, but he was working for the Ace Security Guard Service that night as a crowd control there in the pantry.
Okay, fine. So do we have any idea who was behind him? Of course, we were told it was Sirhan. One person did it, and we've got him now, and we're going to throw him in prison. He's still in prison today.
Yeah.
Was Sirhan simply the patsy in this? Was he the Lee Harvey Oswald or the James Earl Ray? Who really did the shooting, and did he ever have a defense? Did he ever try to prove that he did not kill Kennedy, or what was it all about?
Well, I'm convinced that that both Sirhan and Thane Eugene Cedar were under CIA mind control.
All right, fine.
There was a lady in the scene with Sirhan in the pantry just before Bobby came into the pantry, and they were off to the side drinking coffee. And this lady in the polka dot dress was there to put a amnesia-inducing drug into Sirhan's coffee and to give him a trigger to put him under hypnosis. The drug that she put in his coffee was either rohypnol or scopolamine or a similar drug that induces amnesia for, 30 minutes to a couple hours. And, in fact, Sirhan has never been able, even under hypnosis, to recreate that period of time for about 45 minutes of his life at the time Bobby was killed.
But how would they, you know, get him to actually shoot somebody?
Well, the CIA had been, and one of the Senate hearings was all about the CIA's involvement in the MK Ultra mind control program.
We do have that, but do they get into a Sirhan? You know,
there's actually a letter. You can actually write a letter of Freedom of Information letter to the CIA and send them $35 and they will send you a 3D set. These three CDs contain over 20,000 documents about the CIA's mind control and human experimentation during that time. And one of the documents I found on one of the CDs was a letter to the director of the CIA saying that it would be interesting if they were able to control the mind of a foreigner and have him actually kill a world leader, particularly a president. And down at the bottom of that letter, and I have a copy of that document in my book, and in handwriting, the director says, "This is very interesting. We probably will use this later," or something like that. But in the Senate hearings, the director of the CIA at that time said all documents had been destroyed, but I have over 20,000 documents from that program.
Well, they tried to destroy them, I'm sure, but a lot of them didn't get destroyed, and there were probably some good people working in the CIA who hid them away. We know that there was at least one box of files on the MK-Ultra, and of course, long after the orders had been given to destroy them, somebody wrote in under a Freedom of Information Act request, and they sent them copies of this box of things, and that was the basis of that Senate hearing on MK-Ultra. So there were people in government who were trying to get the truth out, but of course, they didn't want to risk their jobs or their lives. So anyway, so we have now, but who do you think was behind and shooting from behind?
Well, the Thane Eugene Sidor was the shooter from behind.
What was his name?
Thane Eugene Sidor, C-E-S-A-R.
All right, now how do we know that? What's the source of that?
He was interviewed a number of times by both the LAPD and the FBI, but always as a witness, never as a suspect. And and also Phil Mellison wrote an excellent book on Bobby Kennedy's death, and he covered this very well. And of course, the Thomas Noguchi coroner's report tells you all shots came from the rear, from down below. And,
so the 22 bullet, the bullet from the front didn't hit the Bobby Kennedy at all?
No, Sirhan did fire all eight of his shots, and in my book I tell where all the shots went, and Sidor also fired all nine of his 22 caliber shots, and in the book I tell where all nine shots went. So there were 17 shots fired in a very short period of time there in the pantry, and I count for every bullet.
Well, now, what about Rosie Greer and the others? Didn't they realize the shots had come from behind?
There was so much confusion that they didn't notice. They were wrestling with Sirhan, trying to get him under control. But the coroner's report is absolute proof that the shots came from behind.
All right, and of course, I suppose that the real shooter was let off and did whatever happened.
He was never a suspect.
He was never a suspect, right, but I mean, he was the fellow who fired the shots, but is he still around, or is he...
I think he's dead.
Right.
Now, his pistol was rumored that it was thrown into a lake in Arkansas or somewhere, and I'm not sure about the truthfulness, but I've heard that.
All right. And, of course, then everything had to be done to cover up the truth. I mean, how could somebody come in front and then a fellow gets shot from behind? But this is what happened to the Prime Minister Rabin over there in Israel. Why, supposedly he was shot through the spinal cord and then walked four or five steps and got into his car, even though he's totally paraplegic.
Right. Now, the CIA, then proof has come out that they killed at least three other world leaders. In fact, on June 27th, 1954, they had Jacob R. Benz Guzman killed, who was president of Guatemala. And on January the 17th, 1961, they had Prime Minister of the Republic of Congo killed, a fellow named
Patrice Lumumba.
Patrice Lumumba. And then on September 11th, 73, they had Salvador Allende killed, who was president of Chile. And so that's just three of the number of world leaders that they've killed.
They probably killed Diem and Nu over in
Vietnam. Yes, they did. They killed
in Vietnam. So, and, of course, they were killing people all the time. And, of course, then we wonder why nobody ever takes Saddam Hussein out. Well, of course they're not going to take Saddam Hussein out. If we took him out, how could we justify going to war over there?
And the question I have in that regard, we talk about going over there and killing the ruler of a nation, and there's no doubt that he is a very evil person, but it's up to the Iraqis to take care of that. And if it's justified that we go kill Saddam, what about if someone kills President Bush? What are they going to say about that?
Well, see, the interesting thing is, apparently the Iraqi military wanted to take Saddam Hussein out in 1995, and this is a book written by Robert Baer called See No Evil, and our National Security Council wouldn't let him. I mean, I assume that they probably turned all the information over to Saddam so he could kill the military officers who wanted to take him out. But our government would not allow them to take Saddam out in 1995, and the question is why? I mean, this would be the Iraqi people solving their own problem. But, of course, we'd rather send American boys over there to fight and die rather than allow the Iraqis to take him out. But I fear that the war we're going into has much larger implications than simply Iraq alone. I hope and pray I'm wrong. Well, anyway, you've done a fascinating, fascinating job in tracking down the background of these stories. Now, did any of this come out before? You know, you mentioned somebody else had written a book. Did he come up with the same conclusion you did?
No, I'm the only one. Well, in the Bobby Kennedy killing, Phil Melanson is my main source on that.
Now, who is Phil Melanson?
He's a professor, I believe it's North Carolina. But he's an author of several books, and he wrote a national book on Bobby Kennedy. And he gave me permission to quote a lot of his evidence. And in the he proved that both the FBI and LAPD destroyed much of the evidence involved in the Bobby Kennedy killing, and they ignored many witnesses that were very knowledgeable about what really happened, and they wouldn't even interview him, and just on and on about the cover-up of the Bobby Kennedy killing.
So basically, was that this was the Los Angeles Police Department, the hierarchy then, went about to get into this, or was it the FBI that covered it up?
Both destroyed and covered up evidence, and didn't interview people that had the direct knowledge.
Well, you know, it's sort of disillusioning to realize the degree of corruption that we have in our society. I mean,
well, in the case of Bobby Kennedy, you got the LAPD involved, and John Kennedy's death, you got the sheriff of Dallas County involved, and of course, in the Martin Luther King, you got the director of the FBI involved, along with the head of the police department, the fire department there in Memphis. And if someone made a statement to me that if you think you've got good evidence, why don't you turn it over to the authorities and let them investigate? Well, now, who would have turned it over to? The FBI? CIA? Local sheriff? Who would have turned it over to that I could trust?
Well, that's the tragedy. And until the American people are willing to take a stand and get rid of these people, these traitors that we have at the highest levels of our government, nothing's going to change. But maybe God's going to intervene and do what we haven't. But I really fear that when God does intervene, we will not necessarily appreciate what happens. And just as people are judged in the afterlife, why nations are judged in this life, because they have no afterlife. And God does bring his vengeance upon those nations to turn against him and that betray the wonderful gift of freedom that that he has given this nation. So I'm very, very, as Thomas Jefferson said so well, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. And so here we have the cover-up. What about the coroner, Noguchi? I don't suppose he could do much of anything but just explain what happened and be honest about it.
He actually wrote a book about it, and at the time, both the FBI and LAPD tried to get him fired and have his coroner's report discredited, but they were not able to do that because he had so much actual facts and the evidence was so clear that they couldn't get rid of him and they couldn't destroy the coroner's report.
Now, was that a single book or just on Kennedy, or was that the one that involved, was it Lana Turner and two or three other guys?
I haven't read the book. I just know that he wrote a book, and he included his coroner's report in that book about Bobby Kennedy.
All right. We may actually have that book in my library, because I know he wrote about several very significant Robert Wagner's wife and Lana Turner, and there were two or three stories that he had in there, and if he included Bobby Kennedy, I never got to that, and I'm sorry I didn't now, because it sounds like he really had the whole story there, and of course the average American has never heard it. So how many, what was it, about four bullets that actually hit Bobby Kennedy from behind?
Four bullets either broke the skin or went through his, one of the shots went through the shoulder pad of his right shoulder, but didn't break the skin. But three bullets entered his body from the behind.
All right, fine. And first, now, do we have any idea who paid for it? Was it CIA money or FBI money?
I actually have copies of four checks that were written to pay off the killers of Martin Luther King. And that same person that paid for those killings probably paid for John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy also.
Now, was this this fella Carter? Now, who actually wrote the checks?
It was H.L. Hunt.
H.L. Hunt.
Yes.
All right, so he was funding a lot of things then.
And
he was funding the anti-communist movement at that time.
Right. He was heavily involved in John Birch Society.
Well, of course, the thing is, that was Bunker Hunt. Was H.L. Hunt involved?
H.L. was also involved.
All right, fine. Well, the thing is that what they were trying to do was focus our attention on the danger of communism. And not that the communist is not a bad thing, but of course nobody has stopped and realized that we funded communism from its inception. We're still funding it today. We funded the Communist Party here in the United States. It was thoroughly infiltrated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And anybody who's ever read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will remember the words of Bella Dodd, who was in the Central Committee of the Communist Party, when she suddenly realized that the whole thing was being funded by American capitalists.
Yeah, and communism was actually a paper tiger created by the United States leaders.
But you have to have an enemy, just as you have to have Osama bin Laden, the wicked Osama bin Laden, and now it's the wicked Saddam Hussein. Isn't it amazing how quickly we forgot Osama bin Laden?
Right.
And you can just change from enemy to enemy to enemy, and the people will be out in the streets, demonstrating against Osama bin Laden, demonstrating against Saddam Hussein. And they just control our reality. They control our response. It is, who is the person we're supposed to be hating today?
Yeah, the elite actually own all the media. In fact, there was the Congressional Record, one of the congressmen at that time, I believe it was 1907 or 1917.
1917, that article by Oscar Calloway?
I believe it was,
right.
Where he talked about the elite of the time studied, I believe it was 156 banks in the United States to see which ones they were going to have to buy in order to control the press, and turn out they only needed to buy 25 newspapers.
We offered that article for anybody who wants to have it. We got it from the Congressional Record, and it's available. And give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 544-8927. You need to have the information. You need to help us to get the truth out across America, because you're sure never going to get it from ABC, CBS, NBC, or Fox News. Well, we're just about out of time, Galen. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, I encourage all the listeners to listen to what you and I have said, give it serious thought, and do your own research and arrive at your own conclusions. And I think if you do that, you'll agree that we both have been telling the truth.
Well, God bless you. Thanks very much, Galen. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow morning and bright and early.
It's been my pleasure.
Good night. Okay, fine. And that was Galen Ross and his book, The Elite Serial Killers. And if you want any more information, of course, you can call our exchange, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers, because they should be at the lead of this battle. And lastly, remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
hindrance to you typing in those comments, Mike?
What's that?
Is that a hindrance to me typing in
those comments? No.
Okay, I didn't want to distract you.
No, not distracting me at all.
Okay. Here's a couple of articles you probably see we're going to need to sit on.
Fine, thanks so very much. Appreciate it.
You need me tomorrow?
Oh, no.